We've all heard the term self-care, right? Usually, it's someone online sharing their anecdotal life hacks in the form of relaxing wine nights, enjoyable exercise routines, or even talking to a trusted friend. And there's something so appealing about this trend. It stands in stark contrast to much of the more daunting health news we frequently hear about. And as odd as it may seem, taking advice from someone you haven't talked to since high school, they may actually have a point. Interestingly, this trend has coexisted and even thrived amidst a worldwide pandemic. But with the world feeling like it's seemingly ground to a halt, it's been challenging for many to engage in the things they define as self-care. Additionally, much of the discussion of the COVID-19 pandemic has been around what we would define as biological health. A good example of this is the effectiveness of vaccines, the types of treatments we use, etc., the science behind it. But how does the whole self-care thing tie into these discussions of health? The technical term would best be described by the biopsychosocial model of health. Aside from being hard to read, the BPS model of health helps to give legitimacy to the non-biological factors that can have profound impacts on our health, or more accurately, our experience of health. Because all of these dimensions of health relate to one another, something as simple as your little self-care routine could actually make a big difference in how vulnerable your immune system is to infections. On today's episode of Hashtag Health, we'll talk to Dr. Farah Abdulsattar to learn more about the biopsychosocial model of health. And then in part two, we'll take a look at some evidence showing how your psychological and social health can actually influence your susceptibility to upper respiratory infections.
Okay, so I'm Dr. Farah Abdulsattar. I'm a pediatrician and a mother of two children. I wear many hats at work. I am one of the CTU, the pediatric CTU attendings. So that's inpatient service. I also help run a couple of outpatient clinics. One of them is the pediatric movement disorder clinic, and the other is the pediatric acquired brain injury outreach program.
Let's start off by talking about the BPS model of health. What exactly is it? First proposed in 1977, the biopsychosocial model of health represented a novel conceptualization of health. The emergence of the BPS model directed more attention to the psychological and sociological health research fields, with greater emphasis placed on the subjective experience of health and the sociological factors that influence it as well.
So we've known this for some time now, and the shift really happened over the past few years. The focus on the psychological elements as well as the social environment that we live in and how that impacts our biological well-being. Some examples I can think of, I'm a pediatrician, so my examples are going to be pediatrics related. We know, for example, a child's development and developmental health can definitely be impacted by early infant bonding. So them spending time with adult figures, whether it was their biological parents or not. We also know, for example, reading skills in children in elementary school. That is a direct impact of exposure to reading early on in infancy. And again, that is also impacted by the social environment. If their parents are illiterate, it's going to be difficult for them to read to an infant. So that could impact the child's development in terms of reading skills. Something more concrete, for example, asthma control is another one where we know it doesn't matter how many puffers or what medications you're on. If you are in an environment that you live in that can negatively impact your asthma control, it'd be really difficult to manage that. So, for example, exposure to secondhand smoke, wood-burning stoves, examples like that.
An important mediator between these elements of health is the idea of the illness experience.
Interesting topic, illness experience. If you think of your medical textbooks, the medical textbooks were written about a human being that does not exist. They have the signs and they have the symptoms. I have yet to see a patient that fits exactly to the T what textbooks say. That's because we're all different and we're all experience illness completely differently. And that's also has been a shift over the last few years, and that you see more focus on illness experienced by the patient as opposed to what we say is the illness or not the illness. An example of that I can give you is back to asthma. So the Canadian Thoracic Society had put out a statement last year updating their asthma guidelines. And they have an outline of what defines as a poorly controlled asthma that you can use to step up your treatment. And what I really like about these new guidelines, now they have added a line that says, even though you find it, if you see a patient that does not meet the criteria for poorly controlled asthma, yet they experience and they feel that their asthma is poorly controlled, you should consider that as a poorly controlled asthma and you should escalate therapy. So I'm very proud to say that over the years, over the last few years, we're focusing more on that and recognizing that all patients are not going to fit textbooks, and we really got to look at illness from the patient's experience themselves in order to help them.
A key word is subjective. A strictly biomedical approach may only focus on, let's say, the nerves that cause pain, rather than the psychological toll that pain might cause over long periods of time. The subjective or personal experience of that pain may be different for different people. And the BPS model recognizes these differences and better highlights not just the disease, but what we call the illness experience. In this context, the subjective experience of illness can exert effects on the biological course of illness and vice versa.
So in my clinics, I address the psychological and the social actually before I address the biological. I make those my top two priority before I talk about medication. So example, in my pediatric movement disorder clinic, I see quite a few patients with Tourette's syndrome. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, but Tourette's syndrome has motor tics, vocal tics, and there are medications that we can use to try and help decrease the severity of those tics. But we know the mental health and the mental well-being of the individual impacts their tic severity. We know the social settings that impact their tic severity. If they're giving a presentation in front of people they've never met before, meeting strangers for the first time, that can make their tics worse. So when I talk about treatments, I talk about first the psychological. And I say, really, we've got to address if there's any mental health conditions going on, we've got to address that first. And we've got to treat that because we know if we manage that, we can improve tics. Then I move on to the social. You know, what kind of settings bring on your tics? What kind of settings help you suppress your tics or help you improve your tics? Maybe we can work more around these settings. And then lastly, and eventually, and it's my last option for treatment, let's talk about medications at this point. So you really got to address those, and you got to make a point of addressing those when you're seeing your patients, even before you get to your biological component, when you're talking about your patients and their management plan.
Amidst the pandemic, Dr. Abdul Sattar reflects on an amplified need for the BPS model of health.
There was a huge need to use it more. Now, it was all of Canada, not even just Canada, the globe was undergoing a significant stressor. And calling it significant is probably not the right word. It's more than significant. But I found that we needed to resort that more because families were under a lot of stress, especially like early on coming to the hospital, for example, and needing admission. A lot of families did not want to be in the hospital. They feared COVID, right? So I had to really kind of, again, peel the layers, understand what's going on in the family. And a lot of times we have to change our management plan, the biological plan, in accordance to the psychological and the social settings for these families to try and have buy-in from them on our management plans. But I found there was a huge need for it since the pandemic. And to tell you the truth, it's still ongoing. I find now 2 years into it, people are still very highly stressed as a result of that. In terms of the impact on social isolation, I mean, where do I start from that? It's all of our focus has been on COVID, but there's a lot of things that started to emerge as secondary pandemics because of the social isolation. We know, for example, a lot of our children with autism spectrum disorders lost a lot of their services, a lot of their support. We had quite a few of them come into the hospital admitted in severe nutritional deficiencies because at this point, they've lost the supports they have, the occupational therapists who are working with them on their intake. They've lost a lot of that support they have. And there was actually a study by the Canadian Pediatric Surveillance Program that noted an increase in trend in eating disorders in adolescents as well. There's still another study that's ongoing. I don't know the data for that so far is on our ability on detecting child abuse and child neglect. If you think of children going to school, schools was one of the greatest resources we have that they can detect signs of child abuse and child neglect. But with children staying at home, there was no this extra set of eyes looking at the children and making sure that they're safe in their home environment. Again, I don't know the results of these data. They're still collecting data. I look forward to seeing how we did with our ability to detect child abuse and child neglect cases.
And the golden question is, what about that self-care routine?
Do whatever you do to try and prioritize your own mental health. You cannot care for your patients who are already stressed, who have a lot of elements going on for them. You cannot listen for them, giving them your full attention if you are not well yourself. You know, I when I was in medical school, one of the earliest things they told us in medical school was before you used to finish your schooling and go back to life, now it's going to be you do your life and then you go back to medicine. I don't think that's the right approach for this. Okay, it's not, right? To try and make sure that your life is still happening and you do your medicine. And then when you're done your medicine, you put it aside and then you go back to your health and you go back to your life. So wherever your self-care routine is, spending time with family, going out with friends, doing some exercise. For me, it's really spending time with my children and my family. To me, that's my mental well-being and that's how I take care of myself. But you really got to take care of yourself in order to be able to care for your patients. If you're not well yourself, you're not going to be able to do a good job. So this notion of always fall back to medicine, medicine is going to be your life, that's not a healthy approach. No, I don't think so.
Now that we have a better idea of what the BPS model of health is and its importance, in part two, we'll discuss the implications of this knowledge as it relates to the COVID-19 pandemic. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Hashtag Health. If you like this episode, please consider giving us a rating or review and subscribing to our show. You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram at #healthpodcast or send us a like on Facebook. My name is Devin Box, and I will catch you on another episode of Hashtag Health.